You are now listening to Bigfoot and Beyond, featuring the OG bad boys of Bigfoot, the Dr. Heckle and Mr. Jive of Squatchology, the Chip and Dale of Bigfoot, and I'm not talking about the cartoon. Please welcome your hosts, the Bigfoot celebrity couple, Biff Klobo, better known as Cliff Berrickman and James Bobo Fay.
Well, this is the time in the podcast that I'd normally say, "Hey, Bobo, how you doing?" And he would say, "Richard." But he's not here right now, unfortunately. He has other obligations, and luckily some of that obligation has to do with Sasquatch prints out in the woods. He got a report on Facebook he's looking into at this point. And we both agreed that footprints in the ground, even a possibility of footprints in the ground, is a higher priority than a podcast. And I hate to say that because the guest is on the line and he's hearing me say all this stuff.
No, man, I agree with you.
Yeah, nothing personal, Pat. So it's up to me. It's up to me and you, the listener out there, to enjoy this podcast episode. And it's a good one. This is one I've been looking forward to for a while. I think you're really going to enjoy it anyway. Joining me today is Pat Spain. Pat Spain is the host of a couple different television programs. Legend Hunter and Beast Hunter are his two most high-profile ones. Beast Hunter, of course, he went running around looking for cryptids all over the world and whatnot. But we're going to get into all that sort of stuff in a few minutes. So everybody out there, welcome Pat Spain, TV show host and general nice guy and keynote speaker and all sorts of good stuff. So Pat, welcome to Bigfoot and Beyond with Just Cliff today.
I'm so psyched to be here. Thank you very much, Cliff. This is awesome.
Oh, it was awesome to have you on. Absolutely. Now, I met you at Lauren Coleman's International Cryptozoology Museum conference a few years ago.
Yep.
How did Lauren get in contact with you?
So it's funny. So I live in New England, and Lauren's museum is obviously in New England, up in Maine. And a good buddy of mine from growing up is Andy Finkel.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So we grew up together. We were like really, really close friends in third grade. And we kind of lost touch for a little while and then reconnected. And I found out that he had this interest in cryptids. And he's like, "Well, I'm actually coming up around your area. Do you want to meet at the Cryptozoology Museum?" And I said, "I do. I would love to. That would be great." And this was, I think, the year after Beast Hunter. So I had been really sick and I was just starting to feel better. And I think this might've been the first time that I actually left the house in about a year.
Now, when you say you're really sick, I don't know if people know this, but you're a cancer survivor.
I am. Yeah. I had stage 3 colon cancer that was diagnosed just when we finished filming Beast Hunter. It was like a month after wrapping filming, we were still doing some editing. And yeah, that was a wild ride.
I bet. But, yeah, we'll get into that in a little while, but let's talk about Andy for a minute. He's great.
Yeah. Oh, Andy's amazing. So I was feeling better and I was excited to get out there. And I said, "Yeah, let's meet up in the museum." And I said, "You know what? I've heard that Lauren's a really good guy. Why don't I reach out to him?" You know, thinking maybe I've just done this cryptozoology show. Maybe he's heard of me. Maybe he hasn't. I have no idea. But I reached out to Lauren and I said, "Hey, I'm thinking about coming up to the, my name's Pat Spain. I just did this show, Beast Hunter, on Nat Geo." And he wrote back and was like, "Oh, yeah, no, I loved that show. This is great. When are you coming up?" And he said that he would give Andrew and I, a full tour of the museum and kind of have lunch with us and stuff.
Oh, so, that's great.
Yeah, that was my first connection with Lauren. And then he and I stayed in touch after that. And I actually went to his wedding reception, which was super fun, up at the museum. And I got to meet a bunch of other cryptozoologists because, honestly, this world it's not that it was new to me at the time. I've always, I guess, been a cryptozoologist, but I was more of an armchair cryptozoologist. I was really a field biologist. Is what I had done with it, with an interest in crypto and a family history of an interest in crypto. But I had never gone to the conferences or met any of the people whose books I'd read. Like, of course, I'd read Lauren's books and I'd read Hellman's books and I've read, all of these, amazing crypto books. But it seemed like a group that I didn't know how to crack that shell. And Lauren was kind of my first introduction into the world.
Well, that's like entering a building on the top floor.
100%. Yeah, no, I feel very fortunate.
Yeah, and of course, you're a professional biologist. And it's always baffling to me. It's like, why aren't all biologists essentially cryptozoologists? Like, wouldn't they just love to describe a species in a journal, right?
Same question. Yeah, absolutely. It's shocking to me. And I think that people are afraid to look silly. I really think that's what it comes down to. And when you first hear about some cryptids, they sound outrageous. Like you talk about the Mapinguari, and you're like, all right, so this is supposedly this giant one-eyed creature with a mouth in its chest that can kill people with its scream. You know, I'm a zoologist. I'm a, you know, whatever type of biologist you are. I'm a primatologist. There's nothing in the world that looks like that. So I immediately write it off. And you go, yeah. Well, why? Why would you immediately write it off when there are these persistent myths? Let's dig into it a little bit and start to see. Like, we know that known animals are given crazy, crazy details about them that aren't real. Like, I'm a marine biologist but through school, and I can't tell you how many times I've been on the beach and seen parents look at a horseshoe crab and tell their kids not to go near it because it can sting them.
Hmm.
And it's like, no, they're harmless. Like I usually say, any animal with a mouth can bite you. But in order to even be bitten by a horseshoe crab, you have to stick your fingers in their chest and let them start walking.
Yeah, and at that point, you kind of deserve it.
Exactly. It's like getting attacked by a sloth. Like, sure, some sloths are aggressive, but if you get attacked by one, it's your fault.
Well, you know, and there's also, you mentioned something about the scream that will kill you from the Mapinguari, right?
Yeah.
Now, of course, that is clothed in folklore and mythology right there. But, you know, if you dig a little bit deeper, there are precedents for things like that, maybe not that extreme, say for the use of infrasound, for example, with tigers. You know, tigers have infrasonic frequencies and they can stun and paralyze their prey momentarily as they're jumping on them. Well, there's no reason to think that a large animal, whether it's a, some sort of ground sloth or a Sasquatch-like creature living in Brazil, being able to do the same thing. So if you just scratch the surface, that there's some reality behind all this stuff, you know?
100%. Yeah. Look at what a blue whale can do. Anyone who's been near a blue whale, you know, they can stun people. Humans will be knocked unconscious by, you know, some of the supersonic sounds that they can produce. So, I mean, this is not unheard of in nature. And if you even dig further than that and start to really talk to the people who live in the area, which you and I have had the opportunity to do.
Yeah.
And you start to hear that it's not so much that the sound can kill you, but more that it will disrupt your life so much to the point where you may as well be dead. Like it's connecting. My favorite part about doing Beast Hunter was looking at it from a cultural anthropology perspective. And that was that was really the thing that I was the most proud of with that series, was to be able to look at it from the perspective of the individuals who live in the area and who experience this animal, you know, or the myths around these animals on a daily basis, and to really hear it from them. And one of the most kind of aha moments I had on the entire series was in Sumatra. I was talking to a gentleman who had seen Orang Pendek, and I was skeptical and was questioning him because all of the descriptions that he was making sounded like a gibbon to me, just sounded like a gibbon. And he caught on really quickly that I thought that this was a gibbon, and he just started laughing. And I said, oh, you know, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to be a jerk. Like I really want to understand. And he goes, man, all you Westerners, like you don't get it. You know, you don't believe that an animal is real until some white guy has given it a funny name.
Yeah. Or killed it, which is a stepping stone to it, you know?
And it was like, it stopped me in my tracks. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. You're right. Like, and he's like, you don't live here. He goes, the people who don't believe in Orang Pendek are the people who've never been to my forest.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, touche. All right. Fair point.
Yeah. Cultural biases are built in. We don't, it's like a fish wondering if it's wet, you know, doesn't notice the water it's swimming in. And that's the way we all are. We're built in. We have these cultural forces that surround us all the time. And essentially culture is a way to normalize what people believe, right or wrong. Culture is not your friend. And that's been something I've been saying for years. One should rid themselves from culture, you know, to really get a good look at existence as is instead of through these filters.
Yeah. And I love being able to go to the place and have those conversations myself rather than hearing it through a filter, rather than hearing it from, you know, somebody who spent 2 weeks in the bush and, did a write up on this. And I think that if all scientists took that approach, all field biologists really took that approach, then we'd be on the trail of some really interesting animals.
Yeah. So you've been to Sumatra looking for the Orang Pendek. You mentioned the Mapinguari. So you've been to Brazil. I think it's a safe assumption. What other critters have you traversed the globe in search of?
Oh, man. So I was in Mongolia for, of course, the Mongolian death worm, the greatest name in all of cryptozoology.
Sounds badass. It really does.
Yeah. It does. It really does. And all of the powers. I like to say that it sounds like a, an 11-year-old who's hyped up on sugar is describing this animal. He's like, oh, it can shoot lasers out of its mouth, and then it can electrocute you, and it can explode, and it shoots hot blood. It's awesome.
Well, you know, cryptozoologists are basically 10 years old at the end of the day, right?
Because it's a fair point. Yeah.
Yeah. Adventure and excitement and discovery, you know, it's in our blood in a way. So,
yeah. So I've been to Mongolia. I've been up in Canada looking for caddy, and I've done a little bit more sea serpent stuff around here as well. In New England, we've of course got the Gloucester sea serpent, and then I've been out to West Africa, kind of all through a few different countries in West Africa for Mokele Mbembe.
Oh, geez, do you know Adam Davies by any chance?
So he and I have emailed. And super positive, really, really positive experiences, but I've never met him.
Lovely man. I went to Sumatra with him, and, you know, having been to Sumatra yourself, you know, that it really shows you how good we have it here in North America, you know, not just economically either. So Sumatra is just really gnarly, but yet all the people are smiling. All the people are just lovely, lovely people down there, and everybody's smiling, but it's really gnarly just because the jungles, which are, as you know, highly romanticized, but for no good reason, because everything in it is trying to poke you, kill you, poison you.
Harshest environment I've ever been in, hands down.
Yeah, it's terrible. Terrible. But Adam Davies, you know, who I went to Sumatra with, he says, oh yeah, this place is going to get you if you let it, you know, but he said, it's not as bad as West Africa. And he just kept going on about how terrible the environment, the people are lovely. You know, the politics and politicians, you know how they are. So forget the politics of West Africa, but the people are lovely, but the environment has it in for you.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. So I didn't make it to Lake Telly, and I know Lake Telly is kind of the epicenter of all Mokele Mbembe activity. And that's because of the environment. So there were two reasons we didn't make it to Lake Telly. And one was at the time. So this is, you know, going back 10 years, there were all of these, they were rumors, but they were believable enough for the production company Health and Safety to not give us the okay on this, of the very few guides who were bringing people to Lake Telly had caught on that the people they were bringing had more resources than they had been led to believe. So there were a couple examples where they had brought people out and then refused to lead them back, or even worse, taken hostages in order to demand a ransom. And yeah, so we, again, they were rumors, but they were prescient enough that we didn't take that, you know, that risk. So that was one reason. And the other reason is just the environment around Lake Telly is so hostile. I mean, miles of really, really dense, dangerous swamps. And as you know, trekking through swamps is not fun. And carrying, you know, a couple hundred pounds of equipment. And this is before drones. So carrying, you know, a crane and everything else that we bring for production is not easy.
So that, is it worth it to get that shot, huh?
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I remember Adam saying, yeah, like imagine going through waist deep. And of course, he's got the English accent, so I'd love hearing him talk. He's going through waist deep muck, and there's leeches and bugs, and then flies are trying to lay eggs in your eyes, you know? And I was like, oh my God.
No, Brady Barr from Nat Geo, who I had the opportunity to spend a weekend with at a conference. Awesome, awesome guy, and just an amazing biologist. He's caught every crocodilian species, which is such a cool thing. But he went to Lake Telly. And he did make it there. And he still, at the time that we met, he said he still had an unidentified parasite that was in his head.
Oh, jeez.
And we didn't even make it to Lake Telly. But in the Central African Republic, I got infected with Loa Loa worm.
What is that?
Essentially, they breed in your blood, and you get a whole bunch of little worms all inside you. And if you get infected with it, the first time you get infected with it, they all die, and your whole body just feels itchy for a couple days. Like your face feels itchy, the palms of your hands feels itchy, everything, because it's the dead worms getting flushed out of your system. But if you get infected with it over and over and over again, that's the one where you can see an adult worm crawl across people's eyes while they're talking to you.
Charming. Absolutely charming.
So that was, I mean, the whole crew got infected with it. It was just, that was a known thing, but they said, yeah, for the people that live there full time, it gets pretty rough. And we were living with a pygmy tribe, called the Bayaka. And they were the guides that we were working with here. And they were amazing. And there was a parasitologist who was also at the camp. And she was taking samples from everyone who was there, and just said that the parasite load was absolutely unheard of for healthy people. So that's, you know, folks have adapted to living there. But wow, yeah, it was harsh.
Yeah, people adapt. Just, isn't that fantastic? Just absolutely amazing. It also really makes me appreciate how soft I am.
Yes.
You know, I'm just such a wimp. Yeah, and, you know, even the most badass dude I can think of here in the United States is probably pretty wimpy when it comes down to, like, what the things we're talking about here. So,
yeah, no, I think about that a lot as well. Like, there, so I had the opportunity and was so grateful to be able to do the bullet ant ceremony in Brazil, the Tucundera, which really pushes you to the extent of what you think you can put your body through. And it did. It's the only, on a pain scale of 1 to 10, it's the only 10 I've ever experienced. And at the peak of where I ended up, as I mentioned before, I had stage 3 colon cancer, and I ended up in the hospital for a couple months. And at one point, my intestines ruptured. I went septic, and I had to be put in a medically induced coma for 4 days. And when I came out of that, I was in such intense pain that I was on, you know, a morphine IV for a couple weeks and really, really bad stuff. But every 4 hours, the doctors would come in and take all your vitals, and then they'd ask you to give your pain on a 1 to 10 scale. And once I was feeling better, you know, a couple months later, and the doctors had gotten to know my personality, they were joking around with me and they said, you know, you're the only patient we've ever had with this degree of trauma where you never gave yourself a 10. On the pain scale, they said, where you were like writhing in agony, sweating through the sheets, you were in so much pain, you could barely talk and you would mumble 9. You know, they said that's when they knew it was really bad, but they said, you're the only patient who's never had a 10. And I said, that's because I've experienced a 10.
And your scale's been calibrated appropriately. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, this wasn't it. This was bad.
Well, that is such a good story. I mean, it's such an intense, amazing story. Why don't you tell that to our listeners? Because that was on a trip to investigate the Mapinguari, right?
It was. Yeah. So the whole concept behind Beast Hunter was to look at cryptids from a cultural perspective. So it was not to prove whether they are real or not, but to show why they are important. So of course we're looking for them and we're looking to see the veracity of these legends, and I make an assessment at the end of it. But the real point of the show was, no matter what, whether this is real or not, why is it important? So in order to get the real story behind the Mapinguari, we knew that I'd have to live with, I was excited and honored to be able to live with a couple different groups of indigenous peoples, one of which was the Sateré Maué. And they are notoriously untrusting of Westerners, totally, totally understandably, because they have not been treated well by Westerners. And as you know, filming, you're not there for a year. I'm not able to kind of gain their confidence and gain their trust and tell them that I'm not here to exploit you. I'm not here to take advantage of you. I'm here to learn from you. And that's easy to say, but it's much harder to prove that to someone in a short amount of time. So as we're in a production meeting in Bristol, England, a year before filming, I toss out this idea and I say, well, you know what? If I really want to get their respect, I should do the bullet ant ceremony. And everyone at the table just froze. And they went, no, no, you should not. And I said, no, I really think I should. Like, this is something that it'll show respect. It'll be, it'll be a way in to kind of prove to them that I am real, and that I am, you know, if not worthy of their respect, then at least respectful of them. And, you know, to take part in this ritual. And we did a ton of research on it. We spoke with everyone from Justin Schmidt, who's, you know, the king of Sting. He made the Schmidt Pain Index, and he's an expert on.
Yeah, he's a Sting guy, right? Yeah.
He's an expert on bullet ants. And we met with a bunch of other Bullet Ant experts and talked to Steve Backshall's production company, because he was the first Westerner to do the Bullet Ant ceremony. And they believed I was going to be the second. And got it down to essentially they could not guarantee that I wouldn't die, but they could come pretty close to guaranteeing I wouldn't die. But the main concern was what mental effect it would have.
During or long term?
Long term.
Okay.
So I signed a whole bunch of waivers. I stated that it was my idea. I was not being forced into this. I was, you know, and everyone is still super hesitant. But we get to Brazil, and the Bullet Ant ceremony entails, for folks that aren't aware of it, it's called the Tucundera, and it entails going into the forest and collecting, anywhere from 50 to 200 bullet ants, which are one of the largest ants in the world, the second largest, and they have the worst sting of any Hymenoptera, which is, you know, bees, wasps, ants, stinging insects. So it's bad, and the pain builds for about 4 hours from the sting, and then it lasts for another 19. So they call them the 24-hour ant, because it's 24 hours of the most intense pain that your body can possibly go through, and that's one sting. But what the bullet ant ceremony is you collect, 50 to 200, they knock them out using this narcotic solution, and then they fill these gloves with them so that the stings are facing inward. When the ants wake up, they're not happy because they've been woven into these gloves with their stingers facing in. And then anyone in the tribe who wants to be a hunter, which is the highest position in the tribe, has to wear these gloves and sing and dance for 5 minutes. As you're getting stung, just over and over and over and over again. And if you yell or cry out in any way, then it doesn't count and you have to do it again.
So you can't express yourself.
No. So this is what I had volunteered to do. And this is, this intense, awful, awful pain and agony. And the production company at first was totally against it. Then when I did get permission, we get there. And one of the things in the contract was that I had to agree to get a test sting to see if I would go into anaphylaxis.
Yeah, that seems fair enough.
So an hour before the ceremony, I got the test sting, and I've been stung and bit by everything you can think of, man. I've been bitten by black bears and rattlesnakes and a rabid raccoon, and just the list goes on and on. This was like nothing I've ever experienced. So I get this test sting, and I mean, I've worked in labs my whole life as well, and I've spilled strong acid on myself. This was like having hydrochloric acid injected under your skin. It was like nothing. And I turned to the producer and I said, hey, I'm sorry. I don't think I can do this. He went, great. I'm glad. Like, that's completely fine.
Yeah, gained your senses, right?
Yeah. He's like, we got one sting on camera. This is great. We, we're going to film the ceremony with the other initiates who are going to do this.
Now, was that one sting, was it a localized pain or did it spread?
No, that's the weird thing about it, is that it stays completely localized. It doesn't spread beyond your hands at all. So that's why a lot of people who experience this have the sensation that they want their hands to be cut off. And that's absolutely what I felt like. It was like, I just want this to stop. Just cut off my hands, make them go away. So I get this one sting, and then I saw a couple members of the tribe who looked, not disappointed, but, kind of, yeah, no, we didn't think that you would do this. Like, we didn't think that this, and I knew that I would never gain their respect. I would never gain their trust if I didn't do it. So at the last moment I went, no, I'm all in. Let's go. Let's do this.
Yeah. Take the plunge. Yeah. Don't think about it. Just run in and do it.
Yep. And as soon as they put the gloves on me, I said, this was a bad decision. I should not have done this, but it worked. It worked. After the 24 hours, it was actually more like 48 hours of, 24 hours of really intense pain, then I could kind of speak again.
Oh, you couldn't even speak for that day. The 24 hours, you're just...
Oh, I started hallucinating. I had massive hallucinations where I thought that the ants were crawling all over me and all over the crew. I thought kids were eating them. I saw the river, the Amazon, like boiling and blood pouring out of it. I mean, it was...
Wow, just kind of lost your mind.
I've never done hallucinogenic drugs in my life.
You don't need to now.
This is what I can imagine a bad trip would be like. Oh. So it was brutal. I mean, I tried to bite our producer. I headbutted our cameraman. I tackled our sound guy and just screamed uncontrollably.
See, that's Tuesday on Finding Bigfoot. But yeah, not because of hallucinations, though.
Just a normal brawl with the crew.
Stay tuned for more Bigfoot and Beyond with Cliff and Bobo. We'll be right back after these messages.
Well, what do you think about the Mapinguari as a biological entity?
I think so. I believe that we heard it. I believe that there was one night that we were there in a forest where it had been heard before. And what I found about the scream is that it's not that it kills you, but if you even hear this animal, you have to move your entire village, your family, everything out of earshot. So you have to go away from wherever this animal is, which in my mind creates natural gamers, or it creates a natural nature preserve.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
These are the Satsuri Moe are a contacted tribe. That means that they do have limited contact with Westerners, but you have to go through a physical, you have to get special permission from the Brazilian government, everything else. Just beyond their territory are uncontacted tribes. No contact whatsoever with the outside world. So no one from the West, no one from the outside world is going to this region. And those that are only going where the tribes are. So if the tribes are moving out of this area, it creates a nature preserve. And that is where an animal like the Mapinguari could survive. So I believe, just as David Oren does, Dr. Oren, that it is a surviving population of ground sloth.
I was down there for about 2 weeks, and we spoke to a variety of witnesses, and it was kind of split down the middle in their physical description of what they observed. And the name was uniformly Mapinguari, no matter what they saw, they always put that word on it. But about half of them described a very large animal with long claws and, you know, basically a giant ground sloth, just like Dr. Oren, who we also met with, advocates. But the other half, they described it as a monkey with no tail walking on two legs. Did you get both descriptions while you were down there as well, or just one?
So the second description we only got secondhand. So we didn't include it in the episode because it wasn't from any of the actual eyewitnesses that we met with. But I have heard that, and that was a secondhand description that we got, was the monkey with no tail walking on two legs. So in my mind, much like a Reng Pindek, there's quite possibly two different animals that are being described.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I would think as well. It seems that the Sasquatch Range, or, you know, or some close relative thereof, does in fact go down into South America. Just that nobody's really bothered compiling the stories yet, you know, because that's why we know about it from the Pacific Northwest, is because all the early Bigfoot researchers were writing here. But no one has done that to South America yet, to my knowledge. So
no, I don't think with a degree of kind of scientific accuracy that we've seen with the Pacific Northwest. I think a lot of it is due to the region, due to the difficulty of getting down there and to getting all of the necessary permits and the, you know, the visa and everything else. And it's a lot. It's a lot. Without a production company, I would not have been able to do 90% of the research that I did. And without the backing of, you know, an amazing organization like Nat Geo, I wouldn't have had the door opened to a lot of the experiences that I was able to do. I mean, that little you know, yellow rectangle gets you into places that it's pretty remarkable.
Well, yeah, you know, that's something that Lauren Coleman has rightly pointed out again and again, is that the last 10, 15, 20 years, most cryptid research has been funded by reality television shows, essentially. Yeah, which is good and bad, you know, because, I mean, it sounds like you had a very good experience on your show. And of course, on our show, we always told the truth, and we fought real hard, and we won that battle. So, you know, you can trust what you see on Finding Bigfoot as far as Bigfoot stuff goes, yeah. But like, a lot of companies don't care. They're just making a story. And the production companies don't have a vested interest in cryptozoology or Bigfoot or even biology. They're just making a story. They don't care if it's true or not. So it's good and bad.
Yeah, and I've steered away from those. I've gotten offers for that kind of stuff, and I've had the opportunity to do some of that, and it doesn't interest me. It's not something that I'd like to do.
Yeah. So now you mentioned the Orang Pendek. Do you think those are, in fact, real animals as well?
I think that they were. So I think the unfortunate story of Sumatra is a story of extinctions. Sumatra, you know, the forest is broken up. There's not really too large of a contiguous forest any longer that's not broken up by palm oil plantations and slash and burn agriculture and, you know, just the encroaching urbanization of the world. I do think that Orang Pendek was there very recently. And if they are still there, which is entirely possible, that they are either on one of the other islands, one of the other surrounding islands of Sumatra. I mean, there's something like 1,700 different islands that make up Indonesia. Or there are some lone individuals that are still wandering around and aging. And the reason that I think that is a lot of the folks that we met with there, some of the indigenous peoples, as well as just some of the locals that live there, they say that their grandparents have always described Orang Pendek as being a wanderer, as an animal with no home range, with an almost indefinite home range. And they can tell you with a degree of accuracy that any would rival any biologist you know, the home ranges of every known animal. This is how far orangutans go. This is how far gibbons go. This is how far tigers go, tapirs, Sumatran rhinos, all of that. And they say that Orang Pendek had essentially a limitless range. It was a wanderer. They also say that their grandparents described seeing young ones. Their parents did not. And those of them who have seen them had only seen adults, and very, very infrequently. It just leads me to think that, you know, an animal with a large home range where the contiguous forest is broken up in so many ways, it would have a real tough time surviving in those conditions. But I was able to meet with Dr. Morwood, Mike Morwood. And interestingly, it's not to say funny, but interestingly, he and I, when we met, both had the kind of later stages of cancer without realizing it. He and I sat down to coffee. Neither of us were feeling well, and we both thought we picked up something in the forest, but it turned out that we both had cancer, and he unfortunately passed away from it a few months later. But he's an amazing man. I mean, he's the discoverer. He's the person who found the hobbit, the Homo floresiensis. And he said that he had evidence that, you know, he's like, it's not enough to be published in a journal, but I have evidence that Homo floresiensis was there into the 1920s.
No kidding. That's that. Where's that information?
Exactly.
Now?
We've spent years looking for it. So the production company that I work with, we've contacted family, we've contacted everyone, we've tried everything we can, but unfortunately, that's as much as I know.
Yeah, because you're probably aware of the legends of the Ibu Gogo on Flores.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and they're described, you know, this diminutive sort of small, hairy, people-like things. But I wonder, now, I funded a project back in the 2012 to 2016 called the Orang Pendek Project, where I was working with the local people in Sumatra, and if they heard about a sighting of an Orang Pendek, they would go out and scour the area for footprints. And then that, I got some really good stuff, and I got a lot of hoaxed stuff, because unbeknownst to me, my contact over there decided to start paying witnesses, and then everything went to hell after that, basically, you know? Yeah, terrible, terrible decision. I told them to stop it immediately, and when I found out about it, but that polluted the pool. So even the good stuff I have now is essentially worthless because of it. It's interesting, but it's not, you know, it's polluted basically. Based on the footprint casts that we got, it doesn't seem to me that Homo floresiensis could be the Orang Pendek. I think we're talking about something entirely different. I'm much more open to the idea that Orang Pendeks are some sort of bipedal orangutan versus some sort of hominin, like the Ibu Gogo probably is, because it's on the same island.
I'm with you. Yeah, absolutely. I think that we're talking about two different animals. And I think Ibu Gogo is, and Mike thought this as well, that Ibu Gogo is linked to Homo floresiensis. And I think that Orang Pendek is a different creature. And my gut, based on everything I saw and everyone I spoke with, is that Orang Pendek is, I would say, a bipedal and nocturnal gibbon.
Okay, a gibbon instead of an orang. Okay, yeah, that's very possible. Yeah. Are there precedences for bipedal gibbons like there are bipedal orangutans in Southeast Asia?
So not fully. And this is where it gets really interesting as a you know, an evolutionary biologist. So the way that I pieced all this together and the way that I got it to make sense in my mind. So there is a precedence for gibbons walking upright, but they don't do it in a very graceful way. They're always looking for the next thing to grab. They're always looking for the next branch to grab and to immediately go up into the trees. But they do it. So there is precedence for them doing this. They also are the only great ape that is active at night. Not to say that they're nocturnal, but they are active at night. So it's not a far leap to see a group of them branch off and become more active at night than the others and eventually become a separate species. Now, when you're talking about night in the Sumatran forest, you're talking about what's the apex predator in the area? It's the Sumatran tiger. The tigers in Sumatra are known as polite tigers. And when I ask people what that meant, it says they usually want to see people, but not attack them.
That is polite.
It is polite, yeah. But I thought that's so interesting. So what is it about people that makes us not prey? And that brought me, what makes people stand out from any other animal? And it's the way that we walk upright. That separates us from all other animals. So if you're talking about a gibbon that's active at night, that's, you know, getting the benefits of being active at night, all the various flowering plants and fruiting plants and the, you know, being able to exploit a whole different niche in the rainforest. And then you start talking about, well, it's got to deal with tigers. What if by walking upright, it's also getting that, you know, that millisecond of pause from a tiger to go, maybe I don't want to attack this. I don't know what this is. It doesn't look like food anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, so many of the witnesses that we interviewed when we were down there and other ones that I've read about have the hands up in the air as the thing runs away, just like what you're describing with gibbons and orangs and whatnot. That's an interesting perspective on that. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that there are a lot of I think there's a lot of misidentification. I think there are a lot of people who don't see gibbons regularly and who see this animal run away with its arms up in the air and think, oh, that's a ringpindec. But in reality, they are seeing a gibbon. But there's enough sightings from people who are very, very familiar with gibbons and orangs, where they do know that this is a distinct animal, and it walks and it behaves in a very distinct way, and it even has a different call than what we would describe as a gibbon call, different coloration, all of that. That I think there's enough to say that I believe there is or recently was a different species.
Stay tuned for more Bigfoot and Beyond with Cliff and Bobo. We'll be right back after these messages.
You talked about West Africa, Mekele Mbembe. What do you think's going on with that thing? I know you didn't get to the lake, but certainly you spoke to enough people to get some sort of model or picture in your head.
Yeah, so Mekele Mbembe turned out to be one of my favorite stories. to start, I don't believe that there is a living dinosaur species in West Africa. That is a bridge too far for me. But I think that the story is necessary for the area. And the reason I feel that is the different peoples that I was living with over there, the Baka and the Bayaka, collectively called the Aka people. It's the pygmy tribes that are most frequently associated with Mekele Mbembe sightings. And it's a harsh environment. It's a very, very, very harsh environment. And it's really strength and bravery are rewarded amongst all else. And people go missing. People disappear. Most of the fishermen who are on the riverways there cannot swim. And when I asked why, it was a very, you know, you're a Westerner kind of moment. And I felt ashamed having not thought of this. But the rivers are a dangerous place. No one's going in there for fun. You're not playing and splashing and learning to swim as a child the way that we are in the States. It was a total, you know, cultural moment. So most of the fishermen can't swim. And if a canoe tips over, that fisherman's just unfortunately never going to be seen again. But culturally, that's a hard pill to swallow. And having the existence of Mekele Mbembe gives people an out that they may not have had otherwise. And what I mean by that is if when I ask people, you know, oh, what do you do if you see a crocodile? And they say, oh, I have my machete on me. It's fine. I don't worry about crocodiles. And I said, okay, well, what do you do if you see, you know, a giant monitor lizard? Oh, you know, I've got my machete. I've got my arrows. I'm all set. I don't worry about those. What do you do if you see Mekele Mbembe? We get the hell out of there. Like that's the thing that you don't mess with.
Yeah, like the unstoppable force that could get anyone, no matter how badass they are.
Exactly. So if you say, I'm not going to go down to the river at night because there are crocodiles, people will laugh at you. But if you say, I'm not going to go down to the river at night because there's Mekele Mbembe, everyone goes, oh yeah, smart man. Good job. Yeah, don't do that. So it's almost like a culturally acceptable out to make a smart decision that you don't have to make an excuse for. And when someone's canoe, when someone doesn't come back from a fishing expedition, it's, you know, oh, you know, we haven't seen, you know, we haven't seen James in 3 days, but he was the best fisherman we've ever seen. He could navigate those waters better than anyone else. And yes, the rivers are flowing much stronger now than they were before due to climate change. And the rocks are harder to navigate. We've seen people hit the rocks, but there's no way that happened to James. It must have been Mokele Mbembe.
Now, when you're over in Africa, did you hear any stories about unknown hominoids of any sort? Because so few stories leak out of Africa, much like South America, like we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm. So we did. We did. And it was interesting because I kept on getting sidetracked and wanting to chase down all of these other stories. But it was very similar to what we heard here from... you know, from the U.S., it was, well, there are these, you know, large, hairy, it's not a gorilla, it's not a chimp, it's something else, and no one takes this seriously, but, you know, we've seen them. And this was not in the swampy regions, but more in the forest. And, you know, it wasn't a story that we were there to tell, so I didn't really get to follow up on any of them, but we did hear a few people talk about them. And they were in regions that have mountain gorillas, or that have forest gorillas, rather. So it was hard to know whether it was a mistaken identity thing or not. We didn't get to dig into it, but it would be very interesting.
Have you read, I always bring it up with guests who have been to Africa and looked for these things. Have you read that book by Gareth Patterson, Beyond the Secret Elephants?
No, I haven't.
Gareth Patterson, if you don't know who he is, he was like the sidekick of the guy in the, you know, the lion dude in the 70s movie Born Free.
Yes.
Yeah, he was like the sidekick. He was like his apprentice at the time, but now he's gone on to become this world-renowned naturalist. He took it upon himself to study these elephants in South Africa because he had heard that they had gone extinct, at least almost extinct, down to one matriarch. And so he started looking into this area, South Africa, the southernmost population of elephants in the world, and discovered that, nope, rangers are wrong, biologists are wrong. There's like 20 of these things. There's like more than two dozen of these things roaming around. It's not just one left in this troop anymore, in this herd. But while he's doing his elephant research, he started seeing these Sasquatch-like animals, you know, 6-7 feet tall, and taking stories from the locals and all that stuff. I think he's had several sightings at this point. We had him on as a guest in the podcast, but you might be very interested in that book.
Yeah, no, I'll absolutely check that out. That's amazing.
Yeah, I'll send you a link.
Please do, yeah.
I'm assuming you've been to Loch Ness. Is that a safe assumption?
I have. Yeah, I actually filmed an unaired pilot of a series where we assembled a team of all different, you know, from all different backgrounds, and we were going to do a whole series on Loch Ness. But we just did the first episode, which was really fun, and I got some really good scotch out of it.
Yeah, it turns out that, you know, when we went there, they say, you know, they sometimes give you a packet to kind of acclimate you to think what's going on and whatnot. In the packet, it says, don't forget, in Scotland, they call scotch whiskey.
Right.
Well, duh. Yeah, that makes sense, right?
Yep.
Well, what do you think is going on with the Loch Ness thing?
Yeah, I think that they're really fun and interesting stories, but man, I didn't see anything or hear anything that was going to convince me otherwise, that there's something really there. The whole premise that I had of going into that is I could believe it if there are these big tunnels that open up into the ocean. And unfortunately, there are not. There's a couple channels, there's a couple canals, but there's nothing where a large animal could pass through undetected to get to the open ocean. Because otherwise, you're talking about a body of water where, I mean, there are salmon, there are some large fish, but...
Seals make their way up too, right?
Very, very infrequently. And they're usually seen coming and going as well. So it's, I think it's mistaken identity.
Yeah, see, because I think that it's real. And let me explain why. And of course, when I was there, I got to go on the boat and, you know, do all that stuff. But I didn't see anything either. But the reason I think it's real is the stories that come out worldwide in that latitude of river monsters, river snakes, serpents, and stuff, you know, from the West Coast of North America. You know, and first time I ran across witnesses and stories of these things, I was on a Bigfoot trip on the Klamath River in 2008, filming for Monster Quest. I was talking to people about Sasquatches and said, I haven't seen one of those. I've heard them, but I saw one of those river serpents. I go, what? And like in a 4 or 5 day period, I picked up like six stories about these things, and they matched and stuff. Then I started hearing about other stories in other parts of the world, and all the descriptions to me sound like a big old eel, like some sort of giant, because they're clearly not dinosaurs, because they'd be coming up for air all the time. But so they've got to be some sort of fish, and an eel matches the description pretty well, some sort of giant 15 foot long eel or something like that, or 20 foot long eel. And it always has to do with the salmon runs. Like on the Klamath River, the native people there were telling me, it's like, yeah, we haven't seen one of those for a while, but the salmon runs have been terrible. They're kind of going extinct. And then a few years after that, in 2011 or 12, they had a really good salmon run and there was a sighting, right? So then I started thinking about, okay, Loch Ness. Yeah, maybe that's what we're going with, because there is a salmon run and there is the Inverness River goes right up into it. And I don't have any, being in the Pacific Northwest where I am, I have no problem with a large, 15, 20, 30 foot long, slithery, snaky thing making its way through Inverness at night, because steelhead and salmon make their way up through, 6 inches of water at night to avoid predators. So it's not that far of a stretch, but the clincher that's always been my hypothesis, because worldwide at that latitude, there are stories of similar things. So I think it's an ocean going, temperate water sort of critter that comes up, follows the salmon run. But when they did that eDNA study a few years back, what they found was an inordinate amount of eel DNA that seemed to be a little suspicious. So yeah.
And so this is one of the problems with talking about cryptids. When I say I don't think it's real, what I mean is what the general population at large would recognize as Loch Ness, which is like a plesiosaur.
Yeah, certainly not a plesiosaur. It doesn't make sense.
So that's what I mean. And that's one of the things, is that we can talk about the Yeti in a bit, but that's my favorite example of that. But yes, a conger eel, or something, or some other, or some unknown type of eel following a salmon run and making its way into Loch Ness. You could convince me of that all day. You don't even have to convince me of that. That I would buy, absolutely. But what I meant is, I don't think that there's a plesiosaur or anything that would meet the general public's description of Loch Ness.
Okay, I'm totally with you on that one, but I want to keep the door open a little bit for that eel hypothesis.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's one of my favorite things about this is, the Yeti, I absolutely believe that there is veracity to these accounts, but I think that it's nearly impossible for the general public to prove or to accept most cryptids when there's a biological explanation. And what I mean by that is the Mapinguari, unless you find an animal that has a mouth in its chest and one eye and kills people with the screams, then they say, no, you didn't find the Mapinguari. It's really cool that you found a giant ground sloth, but that's not the Mapinguari. If we found an extinct species of polar bear that followed all of the patterns and was in an area that it's never known to have been in, yada, 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 people wouldn't say, people would say, that's really cool, but that's not the Yeti. Mm-hmm. And that's the difficulty. Like you were just saying, if we found a new species of eel in Loch Ness, that's amazing, and it's, biologically interesting. Biologists would love that. There are some cryptozoologists that would love that, but there's a lot of people that would go, yeah, that's cool, but that's not the Loch Ness monster.
Yeah. It's our own idea superimposed over the reality. And frankly, our own ideas of any sort of reality rarely match up to what reality is. And
Even of known animals.
Yeah. Yeah. Even of known animals. Exactly.
Yeah, but that's what makes it exciting.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, let's kind of pulling the strings apart in that knot a little bit to try to get to the root of it all. So now you brought up the Yeti, of course, and people who are well versed in the Yeti literature know that there's three different kinds of Yetis described. The big Bigfoot kind of Yeti, and then there's a smaller ape-like species that there's been footprints, really interesting footprints retrieved from, and of course the bear, and that Brian Sykes tested, a bear hair and proved that the bear hair had bear DNA in it, which is ridiculous, I think.
Yeah. That's the production company that's Icon Films that found that sample. This was a hair sample that was found in a cave. Yeah, no, it's unreal. It's really, really cool. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. So the Yeti thing, do you think that most Yeti stories are explained by the bear species that is present in the same area? Or do you think that there's some sort of hominoid thing going on?
I couldn't rule it out, because I think that the stories, like the biology of the stories, follows such a great pattern. Like, you know, talking about this creature that is sighted at different elevations at different times of year, following, you know, moss, following the appearance of different mosses where it would be getting salt content from, and going back down into the forest and potentially having some kind of color change, like a snowshoe hare or something like that exhibits. It's so interesting, and it's so consistent with other known animals that I would have a hard time saying that all of the sightings are this bear, but I do think that the majority are.
I see. Yeah. Well, certainly there's a lot of inaccessible area out there that anything could be living. Holy smokes. Yeah, the Himalayas are another place that's no joke, but for an entirely different reason. Now, over in that part of Asia, you said you've been to Mongolia for looking for the Mongolian death worm. Now, I got to ask, what in the world is going on with that?
So, it's one that we didn't originally include in the pitch for the series, because it's such a hard sell to say that this is out there. But after a lot of back and forth and a lot of, you know, times where I had to admit that I was showing the bias that I tend to accuse other biologists of having by immediately writing it off, we start to look at all of the traits that it's supposed to have. And you do find all of them in nature, just not all combined in one creature. And it's a region of the world that's so underexplored and so underfilmed and shown that I finally did get on board with, this is going to be a great story. I did not expect to find a Mongolian death worm, but I expected to find a really amazing legend, and we did. So what I think is behind it is that what I found is the nomads in Mongolia live, you know, a interesting and difficult life. And they have it's a Buddhist country, they have an immense respect for all life. And part of that respect is you don't mess with something that you don't have to. So, you know, there's a lot of legends and stories about horses as being the kind of epitome of good within the desert. And the horse takes on all of the traits of the Gobi, as all of the positive aspects of the Gobi. And the Mongolian death worm is kind of the foil to that, to all of the harshness and all of the, you know, the difficulties and all of the things that you face for survival every day are kind of embodied in the Mongolian death worm. I don't think that it's a boogeyman. I don't think it's something where, you know, you warn kids not to go out into the desert because they might find a Mongolian death worm. The way that I heard it, kind of the stories told around the campfire and told to other kids, they talk about it just like it's any other animal. And just like any other animal, if you're not going to eat it, you don't mess with it. Yeah. And, you know, you don't mess with this because it's dangerous. But the nomads that we were living with had these incredibly detailed stories about the dangers of every animal we saw. So when we weren't filming, I would just go out and catch stuff because that's what I do. And I caught this little grass snake, you know, and it was really, really fast. It struck over and over and over again, but the thing's got a tiny mouth. I didn't get, you know, it hit me with its face a couple dozen times, but I think it broke the skin once. But I mean, no danger here at all. It's not venomous. It's got no harm. And I picked it up, and these huge, hulking, football player looking dudes lost their minds. Why would you do that? Put that down. What's wrong with you? And I said, oh, well, what is it? Tell me about it. And they said, that snake will shoot through a camel and impale you while you're riding on your camel through the desert.
Whoa.
And I was like, oh, no.
Really?
No, it won't. But tell me more. So, and they're saying, you know, it's because of how fast it strikes. And when you start to put it together and you start to see, you know, nobody saw this happen, but they saw, you know, bodies. They've seen bodies, and the bodies have a hole in it. And these snakes are around. Well, these snakes eat insects and small animals, which would be around a corpse if you find a corpse. You know, there's insects and small animals. Those prey items might attract the snake. So you come upon a corpse in the desert, you see the snake around there, you see holes in the body from scavengers and from other things. You put those two together and say, nope, don't go near those snakes. They can shoot through and kill you.
I'll be careful.
Exactly. Yeah. So better be safe than sorry. So they did that. There was another one, a toad-faced agama, which is just a cute little lizard. Looks kind of like a horned lizard.
Great name, though.
Yeah, great name, right? Toad-faced agama. Yeah, they're awesome. So I caught one of those, and it was the same kind of reaction. And they're like, no, those eat babies. I'm like, well, they baby crickets. But so they had all of these legends around known animals. And really what it came down to is just, you know, they never wanted us to kill any animal. We weren't on an expedition that would do that anyway. But it was like, no, respect all life. Leave it where it is. Don't go near it. Don't touch it. I mean, we were pulling camel ticks off of ourselves. And they were like, oh, I know they're really gross and annoying, but please just put them back out in the desert where they belong. Like, they shouldn't be on you, but it's not their fault. They're just doing what ticks do.
Well, that's kind of sweet.
Yeah. So, and that's how they treat the Mongolian death worm too. Like, when you read all of the legends of the Mongolian death worm, all of the people who got killed by it messed with it. They poked it with a stick. They dumped gasoline over it. They stomped on it. They, you know, no one was just minding their own business and a Mongolian death worm came over and attacked them.
Yeah. Yeah. We're not prey items for such things, I imagine.
Right. So I don't think that there's every possibility that there's an undiscovered species there of some kind of, you know, sand boa, maybe even some kind of spitting cobra, you know, something that's in just over the border in China. There are a couple spitting snakes. It's not out of the question to think that they could have made their way to there. There could be a burrowing animal like an amphisbaena or a sandfish or something that you could be mistaken. And then all of the traits of it have just been extrapolated over the years based on, you know, the overarching view of don't mess with it if you don't have to.
What would you like to do or go look for that you have not had a chance to do so yet?
I'd love to get back to Sumatra, man. I really, really want to get back to Sumatra and Brazil for the Mapinguari and for the Orang Pendek, because I feel like I left those unfinished. We didn't have the time or the resources to really dig in the way that I would love to. So I'd love to get back there. I'd love to do more Sasquatch research, to be honest with you. It's in our country. And Canada, of course, but it's one of the more, I mean, accessible isn't the right words, but it's one of the more,
No, I think accessible is a good word for that.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
It's right there.
It's right there. Right. And I've never had the chance. I would really, really love to take some time and go up and do some real walks through the woods myself and some hikes and some, you know, go to the heavily sighted populations. And while I was talking in British Columbia to the First Nations up there, they had some really, really great stories. I'd love to get up there. I mean, we were looking for Caddy, but I got to talk to them about Bigfoot as well and their thoughts behind it. And I would love to dig into that.
I know you're a biologist, you're a professional biologist. That's probably your 9-to-5 sort of regular living, but you're also a keynote speaker at a variety of events, not only about your adventures, but also about like the surviving cancer and just a variety of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about that. Or do you have any gigs coming up? And I know it's COVID right now. There aren't a lot of gigs to be had, but is there anything that you'd like our listeners to be aware of?
Sure. Yeah. So I have been hunkered down due to COVID, and I know every animal on all the life cycles of all of the animals that live in my backyard at this point, which is awesome. My daughter's 6, and she and I have gotten out there every day, even in the winter, finding everything we can get our hands on. But as far as the outside gigs go, I filmed a few pilots here and there. Nothing that's taken off. I filmed a couple different episodes of things here and there. But I've also, yeah, I've done a few talks, and I'm always up for more kind of remote speeches. And once the world reopens, more in-person talks. And my website is patsbane.com, so people can contact me there for those speaking opportunities. And I took the time over COVID to finalize 6 different books. So I've just finished 6 books that have been accepted for publication. And I've got the final drafts in right now. I've got the covers all sorted. An amazing artist named Dia Moeller, who is a tattoo artist who did my bullet ant tattoo, drew the covers, and they're gorgeous. And those should be coming out later this year.
Six books.
Yeah.
I didn't even write one. You're writing six.
So it started as one book. And I wrote about 700 pages, and I knew that that was too much. So when I found a publisher, I figured that they would tell me just which parts to cut out. And what was really rewarding for me was they liked it all, but they agreed that it was too much. So they ended up breaking it up into six books and asking me to bulk up each one of the six.
Oh, you already been done writing after 700 pages.
Nope. So I did that, and that was a wild experience, but really fun. So I'm really proud of those. And the name of the series is On the Hunt. And each one, so there's five that are about a different cryptid, but really they're more of just kind of dark, funny travel stories. It's you know, all the crazy things that happen when you're on the road and when you're experiencing these different, you know, places. And then there's one chapter about the cryptid in each one of those five. And then the sixth one is sort of a bridge book, and it's how I started doing this, what my background is, and my cancer story. So how that kind of derailed everything and how I got back on track. And I tell it all through the lens of this trip that I took on my 32nd birthday, of going up to Manitoba, Canada, to lay down in the pit of garter snakes, which is the largest concentration of snakes on Earth. There's a little over 200,000 snakes in this one small area that's like the size of my office. And I got special permission from the government to go up and lay down in this pit of snakes and film an episode of my web show up there. And that kind of brought me back from the depths.
Well, Pat, it has been a great conversation. You're such an interesting person. I'm so pleased that we crossed paths a couple of years ago, and we've stayed in touch all this time. If there's ever anything I can do for you, if you're ever out on the West Coast, I'd love to have you drop by my Bigfoot Museum. I'll take you out to the woods. Maybe we can hear one of these things. Anything I can do for you at any time, just go ahead and reach out. I'm happy to help. Okay.
Awesome. And same here. When you're back in Boston, when the world reopens, let me know. I'll show you all around, and maybe we can do something up in the woods around here.
That'd be great. I'm so sorry Bobo wasn't here today for it. You have to meet him another time. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. This was great.
Okay, Pat, take it easy. Well, there you go, listeners. Pat Spain. All around nice guy. You can see why I love this guy. You know, I met him at Lauren's conference a few years ago. We've been friends ever since. Haven't had much FaceTime with him, of course, but we do speak every once in a while. And what a great resource. This guy is an adventurer, a legitimate biologist, and interested in a lot of the weird stuff I am too. So what a great resource to have. And I hope you enjoyed the conversation. If you did enjoy the conversation, tell everybody in the world you know about the podcast. You know, phone the neighbors, wake the kids, scream it out, you know, on the lawn, yell at some kids, that sort of stuff. Hey, if you're listening to Cliff and Bobo's podcast, you should. And then do what you need to do to spread the word. We really, really appreciate it. And other than that, this is when Bobo would say, keep it squatchy.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Bigfoot and Beyond. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us on iTunes. Subscribe to Bigfoot and Beyond wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Bigfoot and Beyond Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Bigfoot and Beyond, that's an N in the middle, and tweet us your thoughts and questions with the hashtag Bigfoot and Beyond.